It's the perfect time of year. Somewhere far away from here. I feel fine enough, I guess. That's Bare Naked Ladies. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. It is a perfect time of year outside of Toronto. Lots of teams are going to play the rest of this baseball season, fighting for a wild card spot, fighting for a pennant, fighting to make it deeper into the playoffs. The Toronto Blue Jays are not that. They lose 10-4 yesterday, and we see the debut of Joey Loperfido, and we see Paolo Espino get a spot start, and we see a couple of names we're still getting familiar with pop into the lineup. That is the time of year the Blue Jays are facing. It's been since 2019 when we dealt with an end-of-season endgame quite like this. And yeah, there are still a lot of games here to go, 50 or so. And this is what it's going to look like. You're going to look for positives in individual performances. You're going to look at things like, hey, oh, Vlad only had a double yesterday. You know, his slugging percentage over the last 6 weeks actually dropped in a game where you only, quote unquote, went 1-for-4 with a double. You're going to look at what Joey Loperfido is doing. You're going to look at what De Los Santos is doing. Guys auditioning for bench spots next year. Guys coming up off the waiver wire, coming up out of AAA to spot start here and there. This is what it's going to look like. And you can take a fair amount from that. We're going to spend today's show. Today's kind of the front office perspective show. We're going to have Kylie McDaniel of ESPN on, a guy who's worked in multiple front offices, has written books on player development and prospecting, see where he's at on the Blue Jays after this deadline and how they turn a disappointing season that became a solid seller's deadline into a productive 2025. We're going to have Eric Longenhagen on later in the show as well. He's a Fangraphs. He actually co-wrote a book with Kylie on prospecting and player development and things like that. We're going to get the kind of prospect snapshot from him as well, kind of round out. We talked to Baseball America, then we'll do ESPN, then we'll do Fangraphs. We'll get baseball prospectus in there somewhere at some point, an MLB pipeline. But get the whole look here at everything trade deadline. And Ben Nicholson-Smith will join us around 11. We're going to talk a lot about the work that's left to be done for 2025 for this Blue Jays team. And yeah, talk about who's going to get opportunity these next 2 months. That opportunity is probably not going to be the opportunity to fight for an opening day job next year. But you'd imagine that the three bench spots the team will go into next year with, those are in competition right now. If you are Addison Barger and Leo Jimenez and Ernie Clement and De Los Santos, Will Wagner, if he comes up, any number of guys, even Loperfido, who, you know, is going to be an everyday guy the rest of the season here, you know, can you play your way into the strong side of a platoon? Probably not, but can you play your way into a fourth outfielder role that's going to see some starts against righties? And if George Springer needs a DH day, et cetera, those are the kind of things that are on the line. In addition to, you know, rotation spots, they're going to churn 20 relievers the rest of the way. Can one or two of those guys stick in your bullpen? That's where we're at in terms of this time of year. So 10-4 loss yesterday. I mentioned the Vlad aspect of it. So yes, he only went 1-for-4 with a double. Over the last 34 games, he is slugging .799. That is higher than his OPS last year. OPS, on base plus slugging. His slugging alone is higher than on the. It's also, if we look, it's the second best stretch of his career from a slugging perspective. The only, and we're talking narrowly ahead. If you look at that May and June of 2021, when the Jays were bouncing all around ballparks around baseball, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. ended up finishing the season second in MVP voting, his last 34 games are on par with his best 34-game stretch from that season. Obviously, there was a little bit more going on with home runs. That year, he finished the season with 48. He's not going to do that here, but he's been adding so many more doubles in addition to the home runs during this stretch here, that his slugging percentage, again, .799 over the last 34 games, is just a fraction away from the best part of his 2021 season. His OPS, if you want to include on base in there with the slugging, is not far off as well. Over these last 34 games, it's 1.217, and it was 1.248 during that May-June stretch. Now, the important thing to note about that May and June stretch is, well, two things. One, you know, home runs go a long way, right? Especially if you're on a bad team like this one's going to be the rest of the year. So you probably still prefer the 2021 stretch. The other part is, in 2021, he sustained this for like 55, 60 games, not just 34. I use 34 because that's the window we're looking at with Vlad's hot streak here. But in 2021, that was more sustained. If we're still like this in the middle of August and Vlad's still hitting at this rate, then we're going to talk about, hey, was this the best, you know, half season, third of a season of Vlad's career, which is pretty remarkable given where he was in 2021 and given where, you know, where he's been in the lower parts of 2022, 2023, and the start of 2024. A couple other notes to go through from yesterday's game and from around the organization. Dalton Varsho left yesterday's game due to heat-related illness symptoms. Alejandro Kirk also sat out after being hit by a pitch and suffering an elbow contusion the game prior. No IL move for Kirk. We'll see. The Jays are off today. Then they're in New York starting tomorrow. I'd imagine we'll see a few roster moves. You know, if Alejandro Kirk needed an IL stint, the Jays would have to add a catcher to the 40-man. My guess is it would be Phil Clark from the Bisons, who are playing a doubleheader today. So we'll see what their lineup looks like. Maybe that gives us a little hint as to Alejandro Kirk's status. It seems like it didn't seem like anyone was too worried about it. The Varsho thing, I'd imagine with a day off and some fluids, he'll be just fine. But you'll probably see, you know, moves with respect to the bullpen. Paolo Espino came up and started yesterday. Jose Quas got sent down. It's possible they move Paolo Espino to the bullpen in a length role to soak up innings if anyone has a short start or whatever. Also possible they just send him down, call another reliever up because they do have they have an off day today. They have an off day again on Monday. So their bullpen should be fairly well rested. Also the option to, you know, move Bowden Francis into a bullpen role temporarily if they needed that. There's a lot they can do with two off days. And having used the sixth starter here yesterday because of that doubleheader, we know that Friday, Saturday, Sunday is going to be Gausman, Berríos, and Yariel Rodriguez. I'd imagine that Tuesday game coming out of another off day is Chris Bassitt. Then you'd get into Bowden Francis, or if you want to turn the rotation over again, I don't know why you'd do that at this point and start guys on less rest. Just let them get the extra day in. So yeah, I'd imagine it's Bassitt and then Bowden Francis. But again, possible with these extra off days and with Paolo Espino around, that you can use Bowden Francis in a multi-inning roll out of the pen. Also possible we see Yerry Rodriguez get sent back down. He did not have a good time yesterday in that one. Pretty much nobody did. Jackson Holliday getting his first career home run, which was a grand slam off of Yerry Rodriguez, and then he just missed another one. The other note, I guess, on the Baltimore side from this one, Gunnar Henderson made two more errors. He's now made seven in his last seven games. He has 18 total on the season. Only Eli De La Cruz and who else? Maybe O'Neill Cruz have more? The Cruises have more. One or both of the Cruises have more errors than Gunnar Henderson so far this year. And then Jordan Westbrook fractured his hand. He got hit by a pitch from Yerry Rodriguez. Unfortunate one there. They had just traded Connor Norby, called Jackson Holliday up. Now Jordan Westbrook is going to be out for an extended period of time. The Orioles saying they're hopeful he can get back by the end of the season, but obviously this is going to be a multi-week absence. I'd imagine we'll see Kobe Mayo, one of their other top prospects, come up here because the Orioles have a never-ending supply of hitting prospects, apparently. So that one's a little disappointing. So let's turn to a little bit more positive news from the Blue Jays. Shai Davidi of Sportsnet reporting right before we came on here that the Jays have a deal with first-round pick Treya Savage. The deadline for signing your draft picks is 5 p.m. today. So Savage was the one of the highest-ranking draft picks who remained unsigned as of this morning. But Shai reporting that that they'll get that done. He only signed for about $104,000 over slot. So if we look at all of the signings that Jays have done, and these are Shai's numbers that he was kind enough to pass on to me, about $100,000 left above slot before they would hit the overage charges. Now, the Jays do have a couple guys left unsigned. They're 17th, 19th, and 20th round picks. The most notable of those 19th round pick, Damarian Terrell, who everyone kind of assumed you'd have to go way over slot to sign. Doesn't seem like they'll have enough here in slot money to convince Damarian Terrell to go pro versus going back to school. But pretty good work overall. You will have signed your top, 16? I guess Messina's out there as well. The Jays getting Treya Savage signed. That is a positive. You get to wrap that one up and look at the draft class as is. We'll talk to, again, Kylie and Eric Longenhagen throughout the show about maybe where Treya Savage slots into the organization and what that does for the higher end of the team's farm system ranking. Speaking of farm system, and we'll ask those guys about this guy too, Arjun Amala homered again yesterday. So if you remember back, he was the first round pick last year, 20th overall. He goes and plays a complex league. Interesting guy. Obviously the youngest player in last year's draft, would have been one of the youngest players in this year's draft. He's still only 18. The Jays started him at single A Dunedin, which was an aggressive assignment. He struggled. They brought him back on the developmental list, had him work out at the facility for a while, played in a couple complex league games, and since getting back to Single-A Dunedin, has been raking. Over the last, since May 12th, he has an OPS of just shy of 1,000 and has homered 9 times. He's still striking out a lot, but this is an 18-year-old who is 3 years younger than the average player at Single-A, and he's raking like this. 10 home runs in the season, 3 in his last 5, and again, an OPS just shy of 1,000 since May 12th when he went back there after the developmental list and complex league stint. So really encouraging stuff there from Arjun Namala. Because this question gets asked a bunch, and you can always text us to 590-590 and we'll answer texts in the text line. Standard data and messaging rates may apply. We got a bunch of good deadline stuff. We can answer more today about the deadline fallout, what the rest of 2024 looks like here. Fire away to 590-590. The question came up a lot in the last couple of days about Joey Votto's status and whether he could get added to this roster, whether it would have CBT implications, things like that. The latest on Joey Votto is he hits the home run in spring training and then immediately steps on a bat and injures his ankle. He had started to work his way back, had a couple setbacks, started to work his way back, was playing in minor league games fairly regularly, got back to AAA, suffered an ankle injury again. We haven't seen him play since. He's been around Buffalo, so that's maybe encouraging about his proximity to playing again, but absolutely nothing imminent on the Joey Votto front. He would have to get into, you know, at this point, he's probably going to have to restart his rehab assignment. He's been out long enough. Down the line, sure, you activate him. That would be a fun thing down at Rogers Center. You know, maybe you can still stay under the competitive balance tax with the prorated amount of the $2 million he'd be owed or whatever. You can manage it. It'll be a nice boost, but he's got to get healthy and get in some minor league games before we talk too much about that. Before we get to Kylie McDaniel, Ben Nicholson-Smith, and Eric Loggenhagen, I also wanted to play a couple clips from Ross Atkins' media availability the other day. So after the trade deadline passed, during that 6:35 game, we all hopped on a Zoom with Ross Atkins. Some of the tweets came out, quotes and things like that. We saw some stuff in Shai's pieces and Ben's pieces, the Arden on the broadcast, you know, relaying some of that as well. So, you know, all of this is out there. Nothing is new, but I did want to play some of it because I paraphrased some of it yesterday and I did just want to let the clips exist on their own. We've got three here. The first one I wanted to play was, you know, the tone that I've been trying to strike about them having a good deadline is that it is with the caveat that this has been a disappointing season and you shouldn't be sellers. Like, kudos to you for having a good seller's deadline when you weren't supposed to be sellers. Now let's pivot to 2025. Again, we've talked about this a lot. You can hold all those thoughts together at once. You can walk and chew gum at once. But did want to play the clip of Ross Atkins saying similarly and offering you, the fan base, an apology for the way this season has gone.
First and foremost, I'm disappointed that we're here, and it's unacceptable that we are here. And I'm sorry to our fans for that. But the things that I've alluded to about finding better complementary pieces that will help us with our roster construction, I think the opportunities, the underlying issues that we can see are clear areas that we can work on are, one, that building a better 26-man roster and the depth around it that complements, the individuals are complementing others in a better way, and especially as it relates to the run scoring. We have to find a way to create a better run scoring environment, and we feel that the handedness, the power opportunities, the dynamic and versatile athletes that we have added will help us towards that, as something that has been an underlying issue. That's probably the largest one. On a smaller scale, there's always going to be opportunities for adjustments and deployment that we'll have to continue to dig into and make sure we're improving.
So some, you know, Ross Atkins speak there, but you get the point. They didn't want to be in this spot. They hope that, you know, and the other note, I guess, there is that they really tended to focus on the word athleticism came up a lot in that Zoom call. Maybe a feeling that there wasn't enough of that on the position player side in the organization. Obviously, their deadline haul skewed very, very heavily toward the position player side. Jake Bloss being the headline item as a starting pitcher, but Miguel Batista down at A-ball, a teenager, being the only other pitching prospect that they got back. So interesting to hear that. And then the question obviously becomes, and a tone of the show this week has been, okay, well, the only piece you sold from 2025 was Isaiah Kiner-Falefa and Nate Pearson, who, you know, I all respect to Nate Pearson, who has the big fastball and curveball, and hope he has success with the Cubs. Not, in my estimation, a meaningful change to the 2025 outlook. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, really the only 2025 piece you moved on from here. So then the question becomes, okay, you obviously intend to compete in 2025. What does that look like, and how does getting 13 prospects back into the system across a number of different levels, some of whom are close, some of whom might not help for years and years, how does that help with your ability to compete again in 2025? Here was Ross Atkins' answer to that question.
Very, very good question. I think first and foremost, we need to learn about the players we've acquired and then see the development of the players that are currently on our major league roster. Really excited about some of the progress we've seen and the opportunities that have been presented for younger players coming into the fold. Vladdy and George have been awesome and really steady. Varsh has been really steady for us over the last couple of months. And so the pieces that are in place, getting Bo back into the fold, having a better understanding for how those players will be impacted and affected by the players we've acquired and the ones that are already here, is goal number one. And then to answer that question more specifically, having that knowledge, I'll be able to better do at the end of the season. And, you know, there's several ways to make acquisitions, which we will continue to have to do. We're going to have to add in free agency and via trade. And we've just increased the likelihood of doing that by creating more depth and increased flexibility.
So, yeah, the extra depth and flexibility. I mean, I'm sure nobody wants to hear about flexibility anymore in Toronto sports, or inflexibility in the case of the Maple Leafs. But, yeah, look, this is the reality. Some of these guys might elevate to the major league level and offer some depth, whether in a part-time role or bench role in the future. You know, hey, next year, what does the AAA depth look like if someone were to get hurt? You know, you go out and acquire a left fielder. That's an absolute necessary part of the offseason. Okay, what if that person gets hurt, or Varsho or George Springer? Well, okay, now you have Joey Loperfido there, and you probably feel better about that than, say, Nathan Lucas or Cam Eaton. What if an infielder goes down? Okay, well, you have Will Wagner there. What is the backfill? You know, what if you have to trade a Loperfido or something like that? Okay, well, you have Yohaindrik Pinongo, who should be at AAA next year. That depth is important. It is not meaningfully changing what the 2025 everyday lineup looks like, with the exception of potentially Jake Bloss. We'll see how he continues to develop and looks the rest of the season. That's a guy who could get in the mix there. Loperfido is almost certainly going to have a role on the team. We'll talk with Ben Nicholson-Smith a little later about what these competitions are for. They're probably for bench pieces. But the key point there is they're now operating, whether in trade or whether looking at what you have to address in the offseason, there's a little bit more depth to the system on the position player side. You probably don't need to worry as much about, hey, we need an extra, you know, bat at AAA just in case. We need an extra. You don't have to go out and spend $7.5 million on, a guy who's going to bounce around the infield, because you have a lot of options to fill that in-house, and you'd hope someone breaks through and develops. Those starting spots, though, are still big question marks. Don't think Will Wagner is going to pencil in as the everyday third baseman. Don't think Charles McAdoo is going to pencil in as the everyday third baseman. Don't think Yohaindrik Pinongo is going to pencil in as the everyday left fielder. And I don't think any of those guys are going to add, 35 home runs that this lineup probably needs to go out and try to find, whether across one player or a couple different players who can add, 25. So we'll see. Still a lot of work to be done. On the Loperfido note, did want to play one quick clip from Atkins on Loperfido, because he did start yesterday, play left field, hit second. A couple of strikeouts to start things off for him. But, he got in there. He got a single in the ninth inning to make sure that debut had something on the positive ledger. I think we're going to see a lot of him here. John Schneider seems like he's pretty high on him. And this is what Atkins had to say.
Yeah, really interesting. He's a late bloomer. He came into his strength later than the average player his age, and has already had a ton of minor league success for someone that has continued to get better. So I think it's coming into his athleticism and strength and learning how to maximize it for him.
Yeah, and learning how to, and look, he was probably a little geeked up yesterday, those first two strikeouts to start the game. The first one, I don't know if you watched Kevin Biggio in LA lately. I'm sure Jays fans, a strikeout looking. No, he got fooled on that one. But there's a lot to like with Loperfido. It's funny. It's always interesting. The guys who have home run power and the ability to steal a base, like those guys get on the fantasy baseball radar before they get on the everyday baseball player radar. Who's the guy the Nationals just called? Alex Call. filling in for Lane Thomas. Like, oh, he's not good, but he hit some home runs and he steals some bases. I think, you know, even at the low end, Lo Profito is going to be able to do some of that. Obviously, the Blue Jays hope that he can develop into, you know, a more well-rounded player, the kind of player that his minor league numbers suggest that he can be, that his prospect rankings before he became a major leaguer suggests that he could be. That'll be a lot of fun to track. And by all accounts, like Hazel May had a piece on the broadcast on Tuesday, I want to say, that she talked to some people who know Lo Profito, and he's an 80 grade dude, just like a good guy to have around, cooks paella for the team, good vibes guy. That's not everything, but that positivity and that energy is something that has been lacking a little bit this year, and we're going to need it down the stretch here. So excited to see how Lo Profito plays out, excited to see where Jake Bloss ends up once they have intaken him at the complex down in Florida and decide what's next for him. Lots to be excited about medium term. It's going to be a little bleak the next 2 months here, but whatever. This is the situation you're in. We'll deal with it. We'll see if any of these guys can make a good case for roles for 2025 the rest of the way. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Kylie McDaniel, ESPN Baseball Insider. We've talked a lot to Kylie heading into the draft, heading into the trade deadline, about this front office, their strengths and weaknesses, the uncertainty around job security and things like that. Let's see what Kylie thought of their deadline day and where this Blue Jays organization stands after it. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's the Little Bare Naked Ladies, the second concert I ever went to. I've seen Alan Doyle of Great Big Sea next weekend with my brother, my family's newfie. So Great Big Sea was the first concert I ever went to. Excited for that one. And then Bare Naked Ladies was number two. I got cooler, but no less Canadian as we go. Really looking forward to Alexis on Fire in a couple weeks at Rogers Center, too, with Blink. Our next guest does not care about this music chatter. He does care about the deadline day of the Jays. Maybe if I had dog chatter, Kylie McDaniel, baseball insider at ESPN and author of Future Value, would be fired up. How we doing, man? You get some downtime with the pups, some good hikes in post-deadline here?
Yeah, I actually was rewatching Community, and there's a joke when somebody's so familiar with Bare Naked Ladies, they call them BNL, and then Joel McHale got mad that he calls them BNL, like everyone knows who that is, but maybe everybody does that's listening to this.
In Canada, yeah, like that's, I know that they had some breakthrough success in the U.S., like I think 1 week became a song there, you know, popped up in some movies and things like that. But there are.
I still joke that someone can guess a song if I just say it's Ben. Like that's all you need, and everyone knows exactly. At least that's my age knows exactly what song you're singing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a tremendously annoying earworm, but good for them for getting it through there. Kylie, it's been about 2 days now since the trade deadline, day and a half here. How you feeling, man? How was deadline day for you? How chaotic is that? I know you're breaking news and stuff like that, and you're also trying to evaluate the prospects. You had a piece out today, you know, kind of breaking down the prospect, the 89. Prospects that got dealt. How was that day for you?
Hectic. It's one of the few days a year where I'm flying into Bristol, and then because I'm there, I'm having meetings with executives, the people that I kind of see, you know, once or twice a year. We obviously have the show. There's the sort of meetings ahead of time about what we're doing, and then I'm also going into like our sort of cubicle office situation. Passon's popping in with his suit when we're reporting things. I broke part of a trade while getting a wrap at the cafeteria and got a lot of high fives for that one. They said it was the most productive sandwich that's been ordered at the cafeteria in a long time. So just like a lot of weird stuff that occurs, especially when like my sort of Super Bowl is the draft, and then also doing the prospects at the trade deadline and now getting more into breaking news and then being at ESPN and then broadcasting the draft at a rodeo. Hadn't done that before. Just like a lot of things all crammed in together. And I'm actually leaving tonight to go to Birmingham to go watch the best 2025 high school draft prospects from east of the Mississippi. So after this, I will finally have like slowed down my travel and intensity, and then I can sort of shift my gaze to, you know, if the Braves make a playoff game, I'll be going to that. But all of my intensity ratchets down significantly in like the next couple days.
Nice. I like how specific that is. All the best 2025 high school prospects east of the Mississippi. All right. All right, man. Yeah, I know the draft is your Super Bowl. That's a big thing. We talked to you a bunch about the draft, but just quickly, Shai Davidi of Sportsnet reported right before we came on here that Treya Savage signed for about $100K over slot. So the Jays, most of their work is done. Was there any chatter that wouldn't get done at all? It seemed from our side in Toronto like it was an inevitability. But anytime it comes down to like 6 hours from the deadline, there's a little curiosity, at least on my end.
Yeah, Savage was seen before his end of the season where there was the injuries that he would go in the 8 to 15 area. And so the fact that he got outside of that area, I think, might have been most of the, you know, maybe expectations weren't met. Maybe there was an overslot. Maybe his, I don't know this, maybe his camp tells Toronto, hey, go sign everybody else and then give us whatever you have left, et cetera, et cetera. I would imagine that was the extent of it. I was talking to some people involved in this last night, and they were just like, yeah, I think it'll get done. So, yeah, and luckily they did not lie to me, like some people have this week.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we can name names if you want. You could burn those bridges right now. Otherwise, we can move
no,
on to the trade deadline.
No, they just
won't
get texted as often. No, not as trustworthy as I'd like it to be.
All right. Okay, so that was how the Jays added, what, I think it's 16 or 17 guys to their system via the draft. And who they've signed here. They also added 13 prospects to their system at the trade deadline, trading away 6 pending free agents, Nate Pearson and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. High level, what did you think of the Blue Jays' work on deadline day?
Did pretty well because it didn't seem like Bichette, Guerrero, like that wasn't going to get solved because I think every time I come on here, there's the big picture, what are we doing here discussion.
Yeah, you have those if you're a bad team.
Yeah. That wasn't getting solved in this deadline. Those guys aren't going to magically get healthy and get better and then get extended. And then the team's looking like a playoff team on paper for next year. That's got like a little more ways to go. So given what they could do, which is rentals like Kikuchi and Richards and Jansen, all those guys got moved. I think the value in all of them was pretty good. The Kikuchi trade specifically was one of the 3 or 4 biggest overpays by the acquiring team. So Toronto did a great job. Getting Jake Bloss and Joey Loperfido, specifically those two guys, sort of define it as an overpay. And I also think Charles McAdoo, acquired from Pittsburgh, was sort of one of the sleepers. If everyone wants to go to ESPN.com and read my article about the top, I think it's 26 plus 10 others that were traded at the deadline. There's like a unusual amount of guys that went somewhere between, you know, the 6th to 10th round or the 11th to 20th round, who were essentially unknown to me. Most of these guys I like knew the name but couldn't tell you much about them, that have become real prospects in the year after the trade. There's like 6 or 7 guys where that describes them, and McAdoo's one of them, who was a, you know, not really well-known guy out of San Jose State that went in, I think, the 15th or 13th round, something like that, and is already in Double-A in his first full pro season. So he looks like he might be like a real guy, could be in that Kevin Biggio, Davis Schneider, like in that general area, like a guy you don't necessarily expect when he gets drafted to turn into a guy, maybe Addison Barger. Obviously, there's been a number of those guys that have come through, and this may be another one that was in a, you know, lower profile deal, so it could be a nice find.
Yeah, and look, anytime, look, people are going to differ in how much they hug their prospects and stuff, but I do find it at least like a slightly useful data point if the other team's fan base is mad about the trade, and that was the case in the Astros trade and the Pirates trade. I like Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. You know, I didn't love the signing, was proven wrong on that here, but you can turn that into a Double-A prospect who's got, you know, tons and tons. It doesn't even have to be 40 manned for 2 years still. Like, that's a pretty nice a pretty nice piece of business there. So when you broke these down, again, everyone can go to ESPN and look at how you ranked them out. No top 100 prospects were traded. However, there were 4 or 5 that would slot into that maybe like 100 to 125 range, guys who have a future value grade of 50 from you. And Jake Bloss was one of those. What do you like? Again, and this is another guy who has not been pro all that long, has already made it to the major league. So there's obviously some proximity to the majors there that's a factor. What else do you like about Jake Bloss?
He's a bizarre story. Like I mentioned, there were a bunch of like lesser known college prospects that have turned into guys. Blas was a 22-year-old grad student at Georgetown at this point last year, maybe let's say 15 months ago, that was thinking about what finance job he wanted to take. He was looking to be a guy in finance. And then all of a sudden he got an agent. He became a third round pick. I think I had him in the third to fourth round as a guy that has like above average stuff, is a little bit older, will probably have to move quickly, has sort of a relief look, is like sort of a nice guy to have, like an inventory arm, a guy that could be a second or third guy in a trade. So the third round was like maybe a little round higher than people expected. And then within a year, he's on the verge of being a top 100 prospect, has made his debut, and now looks like a starter with above average stuff from, again, 15 months ago, didn't think he was going to play pro baseball, wasn't even really thinking about it. So that's like a crazy story that there's like very few guys that have gone that path before. And actually, when I was finishing up this ranking, I ran it by a couple pro scouting directors and I had Blas at like 7 or 8 as, you know, maybe 150th, 160th on the overall list. And they were, and like multiple guys were like, oh, our guys have him a little higher than that. It's like, it's more, you know, 110 to 120, like kind of breaking into, basically he'll be a top 100 prospect right when he graduates. So for that guy to have that story in Houston to find him, they have had a, we'll say a now medium term, like multiple years of doing a good job in the draft and then trading almost all of those guys away to try to prop up what's left of what is a, you know, very talented team, a lot of really good players. But they may look back on this and frown looking at all these trades they've made and with Ryan Clifford and Drew Gilbert and then now Jake Blas and Joey Loperfido. Like there's going to be a dude in this group, and Jake Blas might have the best chance of all of those guys to turn into the guy that Houston regrets.
Well, I'll say this, as far as lighting your capitalism degree on fire to change careers for a career in sports goes, he made out better than I did getting a $500,000 signing bonus and already getting a major league salary, but I respect the aggressive career change from him. So when we look at the Blue Jays farm system as a whole, now I know you haven't re-ranked it yet. You'll do an updated top.
Oh, I have. It's just not public yet. But
oh,
go ahead.
Okay. Are you willing to? So you had Blas at a 50 grade, Loperfido at a 45 plus, McAdoo and Class A at a 40 plus, and Cutter Coffee at a 40 future value. So that's what? That's five guys that you had on that list of top, you know, 35-ish guys who got dealt on deadline day. Between that and the draft, how much of an injection has this been for the Jays' overall farm picture?
So I had them starting the season at 24th. They're now at 22nd. They have gained some value. The issue is, other than Blas, there is not a top 100 guy. And as I always say, like, there can be 6 to 8 guys added in that 150 to 300 area. It does not move the needle as much as if you have one top 6 or 7 guy in the draft that you acquire. That guy will be worth all of those players and a little bit more. So because there wasn't that huge guy added, and I think there were a couple guys that have graduated of some note, the system hasn't taken a huge step forward, but it is improving. I think they did a good job. And I guess now the conversation will turn to what is the next first draft pick? Sorry, my dog just entered the room with a squeak toy. There's no way to plan for this.
You have multiple dogs, right?
Yes, only one in the room so far. Okay. So we'll see if the other one decides to join us.
All right. What's his name or her name?
Farley, his.
Okay. All right. Okay. So when it comes to how the overall farm ranking values guys, can you tell me if this is a fairly accurate way to describe it to people? Because like I do think people will be a little surprised, be like, well, they got 13 guys and their farm system only went up a couple spots here. And obviously there's a lot, you know, prospects can get downgraded, Aravis Martinez gets suspended, Ricky Tiedemann gets hurt again, et cetera. But like the old, like if you go back and play a video game from like 2005, you could always get a trade through by just like adding another second round pick, adding a, in basketball, just add second round picks until the computer says yes, because that little bit of value adds up over and over again. And then eventually the people who made, like you could, in Madden, you could sign every free agent running back, trade them for a third round pick, and then trade a bunch of third round picks for a first round pick. But eventually the trade engines got smart and it was like, okay, the marginal value of adding an extra third, an extra third, an extra third, it doesn't actually matter much. And they've done this, you know, the baseball games have caught up too, where adding a whole bunch of 30 future value guys doesn't really do anything. Is that a fair way to kind of capture it? Like, it's important, it's nice to have those guys, but there is a diminishing returns to having bulk depth at the lower end.
Yes, at the beginning of sort of the moneyballization of the baseball internet to try to understand how teams operate, there was a belief that there's like 2 meters of like how much are these players worth? And like you were saying, if you just keep adding more guys, eventually this one gets higher than that one, and then the trade evens out. And what it really is how much value do you get, and then how much is there sort of per asset, we'll say. So, like, you can give me $65 million in value of prospects and players and picks and all those sorts of things, but if it's over 10 players, it's obviously worth a lot less than if it's over 2 players. And so there's a balance between those two things that I think those early video game engines were not reflecting reality. And so that also was reflected in the sort of empirical study that we did at Fangraphs with Craig Edwards, and Eric Longhagen, and myself about how prospects are rated, which is the, using broad numbers, the 50th prospect in baseball, so like in the middle of a top 100, is worth like 9 Trey Savages, which seems silly, but that's also kind of how it works, that if you were trying to trade Trey Savage for the 3rd best pitching prospect in baseball or whatever it is, you'd need a lot of them. Like, you instinctually you would say, oh, like 2 or 3, maybe 4, and that feels right, but then you couldn't get that team to trade the better player for 4 lesser players, because that seems like trading, you know, $1 for $4 or, you know, whatever it is. And so you have to overwhelm them because of the difference in those like tiers of talent, because that top guy has much higher odds of making an all-star game or being that kind of guy. And Trey Savage has significantly less just because of what he is right now. And so effectively it's 6 or 7 or 8 or, you know, whatever the number is between those two guys. And so if you add a lot of guys at his level and lower in the draft and in trading or in free agency or, you know, whatever it is, international signings, then you're doing a good job creating depth. There's things that can't necessarily be quantified, that there's a bunch of $2 million assets, but the $100 million 5th prospect in baseball is just on a completely different plane to where you can't even really compare them. They don't go in the same trade. That lesser player doesn't change the math at all, which seems like counterintuitive, but that's effectively how it is treated, and that's what the research says, even though that is not satisfying to hear. You added 7 prospects and then 14 in the draft, and you got a little bit better. For reference, also the Marlins farm system, I believe, went from $80 million to $175 million, and they moved from 28th to 20th. They were just in an area where you have to make huge strides
to
move up.
Yeah.
And they almost tripled the value of their farm system, and they're still in the bottom half. But if they, but they're now at the point where all these guys are tightly packed in that like 12 to 20 area, and they're at the back of it. And so if they were to do one more big trade and get like 2 top 100 prospects, they'd jump to 12 and would have effectively moved 8 spots with 2 players after adding 20 players and adding 8 spots. It's just, you know, sometimes it doesn't make logical sense, but that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, and then there are other small things too, like, hey, if you know, obviously you only get so many minor league contracts. So if you, the Jays had to release like 12 guys already from their minor league system to make room for these guys. If you, like, even if these guys don't have a value that really matters for the farm system ranking that we look at, if you replace a guy that has a 0.1% chance of becoming something with a guy who has a 1% chance of becoming something, that, you know, over time, over 10 years, you know, you find one extra guy or something like that, and it ends up mattering there. And what you're describing, again, like, I agree with you. It's not like it's not satisfying to hear. It doesn't sound right, even though that's how the market's operated. And that's how we end up with a trade deadline where 89 prospects get dealt. It's been framed as a seller's deadline, and nobody in the top 100 moved because teams value those guys so highly. So what do you make of this idea that it was a seller's market? Because teams like the Marlins and the Jays did do pretty well as sellers, but it was really a quantity over top quality kind of seller's market.
Yeah, it's because of the way that the standings are jumbled up a little more than usual, and we have the added wild card, and we're also, what is it, 2 months away from the end of the season. So the amount of teams that can justify, hey, if we go on a little bit of a run here, if we fill the 2 holes we have some guys coming off the IL, like, how many teams can justify going for it if everything says they want to go for it, but they're 5 games out of the last wild card spot? It's like 22, 23 teams can justify it. And of the teams that are definite sellers, sometimes their, you know, best trade assets are Luis Robert or Garrett Crochet or Tarik Skubal, where it's like, well, we can't trade that guy. That doesn't make sense. Or in the Rays case with Isak Paredes, they had 3.5 years of control, and they think they're going to be be a playoff team the next 3 years. So he's a guy they want to hang on to. But then when they're like, well, but he's going to be in arbitration the whole time. He's going to go from league minimum to 4 to 8 to 12 to 15 million. Eventually that guy's going to be too expensive and not have that much trade value. We have some guys coming behind him. Nobody's selling. We'd like to flip this guy into 3 or 4 guys that can do a version of this. So you saw Miami go from, we're going to trade 4 or 5 guys to we're going to trade 10 guys. And Tampa being from, I think we're going to sell to, oh, we're not going to have the opportunity to sell the next 3 years if things go the way we think they're going to go. So let's take advantage of this opportunity where prices are artificially high. Not you're going to get 3 top 50 prospects in baseball. You're going to get 4 guys instead of 3, or that second piece is going to be better than it normally would. And we saw a couple trades, Kikuchi being one of them, where it was on paper like a clear overpay. And then there were other guys like Yimi Garcia. Seems like he should have gotten what Jason Adam got or what Carlos Estevez got or in the area, and he didn't. And I don't really know why. It could have just been there were 4 teams willing to overpay for a player, and they just happened to pick another guy. And so the overpay didn't come to you because the market isn't always like a very smooth, everyone gets exactly the same thing. And it's just like a, you know, a Gaussian curve where everyone is like falls neatly on that curve. Sometimes it's real lumpy. And there's 4 irrational GMs that want to do something crazy, but only for these 4 guys. And there might have been 6 other teams that wanted to wildly overpay for Garrett Crochet, and the White Sox just didn't want to trade him. That's the sort of stuff that, like, you know, Jeff Passan is better at this than I am. But you sort of figure out after the deadline, you sort of hear, oh, this was the top 100 prospect that was the hangup in the Garrett Crochet talks with this team, or this guy had a medical, or and now today's the draft deadline, you're hearing like, hey, there's 2 high school pitchers that turned down $3 million. That's not going to be technically reported, but it's sort of wild. Because I don't think people are going to know that that's the amount of money they got turned down. And then we'll see what they turn into in college. But the track record of that is Garrett Cole has successfully done that. And I can't really think of other guys. And so there's a lot of, we'll say, outlier behavior that you then sort of find out at the end that people don't want to tell you ahead of time because they don't want to tip their hand. But to me, it's the most interesting part of baseball is hearing, like at this event, I'm probably going to have 5 or 6 teams tell me what their board was at their first 3 picks and who they wanted to take and then who got, you know, picked in front of them, who they ended up with, what money they wanted to spend on this guy, but he wanted to go to school. There was a big NIL package is now a thing that comes up more now. This happens in the draft. This happens in the international game. This happens in the trade market. And it's not always fully explainable because it's a bunch of humans dealing with each other. So it then becomes unexplainable or unpredictable, at least.
I love events like that. Like when I was on basketball, I would go to Summer League every summer in July. And like you can find out from teams, yeah, oh, this is what the board looked like. There was 1 year the Raptors had the second last pick in the draft. And they ended up for training camp with 4 guys on the roster that they had considered with that spot, just like the way it worked out. And I don't know, it's interesting to hear the baseball side of it as well. And then it's interesting to think on things like, oh, it was such a seller's market. You got this much for Kikuchi. You know, why didn't you explore trading Chris Bassett, for example? Well, what you're laying out is like maybe there wasn't a team willing to pay that for Chris Bassett, who has a year at $21 million next year. Maybe the team's willing to spend on a pitcher, spent on Kikuchi and Flaherty and Eric Fetty. What do you make of, like, again, acknowledging that what the Jays did was pretty good work in a bad situation they didn't want to be in. The fact that they didn't get, you know, given what the market looked like, that they didn't go raise mode and put a little bit more of their guys with term into the pile there. Thinking specifically Bassett and Chad Green here, basically.
Yeah, I would imagine it's because what it's been explained to me sort of through secondary sources is the Jays ownership, you know, president, GM, whatever it is, don't want to do a complete teardown, that they've put enough into this team with a big enough payroll, with the expectations and the stars and all these things, that just going down to zero and being bad for 3 years or, you know, 2 years if you're lucky, 4 if you're not lucky, is not a thing they wanted to do. And so trading Bichette and Guerrero was not an option. Trading the rentals in a year where you're not going to make the playoffs is an option. And so then you have to, as a GM, you then have to work within the constraints you're given. And I would also say that the appetite for teams to add a guy making $20 million next year, like that's a different question than do we want to add Kikuchi for, you know, whatever it is, $6 million for the rest of the year. And these prospects, he's going to make 9 starts, hopefully be a playoff starter. That's like a very simple situation that often you've already been approved to add payroll and you're deciding how to add it. Whereas adding a guy for next year is like, all right, well, we're now preempting free agency. We're committing money. I don't know what my payroll is next year. A lot of teams like Minnesota couldn't add any money tied to their TV deal. And so some teams are like, I can't add money now. I also can't add money next year. Or if I can, I'll know in February. I'm not going to know now. So just a more complicated situation. And I also think the Jays, if I had to guess, think they might have a chance to be competitive next year. So they also don't want to give away next year's guys if they're then going to have to go find another Chris Bassett type guy in the market somewhere in the winter anyway. We already have this guy. We like him. If somebody wants to wildly overpay, if it turns out Chris Bassett under contract for next year is going to be one of those five crazy overpays, then I imagine that would be a conversation. And you don't have to have that guy marketed as a trade product. Somebody is then going to call and ask if they want to overpay. And I would imagine, I mean, I've been involved in this before. I was in Atlanta during the Shelby Miller trade, which, you know, Dansby Swanson and all those guys. When we heard, hey, Arizona came back with this offer, I'm like, that's double what we were going to ask for. Good thing we let that guy talk first. Like the excitement in the room when you find out you're the team that's going to get an overpay and you're just deciding what kind of overpay you want. It's like a high that lasts for a year, basically, because usually you're not a good team having a bad season. And so hitting a home run of a trade, like that trade ended up being Dansby Swanson, and then basically none of the other guys really mattered. Ender Inciarte was a very good player for a couple years, and then the extension didn't go that well, and Swanson became like a franchise guy for Shelby Miller, who was not a very good player. That is a dream that does not happen very often. In fact, that was the reference a lot of teams would make in the next couple years, is, oh, we're looking to make a deal, we're willing to be aggressive, we're not making one of those Dansby Swanson trades though. So the idea that Jake Bloss could be like in the rotation for six straight years, three of them at the league minimum, three for a discount for like nine starts of Kikuchi, is like sort of insane. Like, it should be celebrated, even if like my rankings don't necessarily really want to celebrate it. That, you know, that's math. Let's talk about people. That's a great thing.
Yeah, and Loprofito and Wagner could be, you know, bench pieces next year, and those guys, you know, similar to the farm system rankings, if you're ranking an actual major league team, you don't care as much about the 12th guy and the 11th guy as you do the guy who's hitting cleanup every day. But those things matter and add up. So before I let you go here, let's turn it that way. The Jays, and I, you know, everything we've said here in Toronto leading up to this is basically what you just said, that, you know, secondhand sources suggested, which is that this team wants to compete again next year. Now, maybe they do that with their finger over the eject button if it gets off to a bad start again. We'll see. There's obviously Vlad and Bo extensions. But if they're going to compete again for 2025, they did all of this trading with Isaiah Kiner-Falefa really the only piece that comes off their 2025 roster. They could still go re-sign all the guys they traded away if they want, other than Isaiah Kiner-Falefa and Nate Pearson. So when you look at where they're at now, the farm system in a little bit better of a spot, whether that's to graduate guys or to trade, you know, turn around and trade prospects or whatever, just how much work do the Blue Jays have to do, and how difficult is that going to be in this offseason to, like they got to make up like 20, by the time the season ends, they're going to probably have to make up like an extra 20 games worth versus 2024.
I think the lineup is like close enough to what it would need to be competitive if things kind of, you know, take like a 60-70 percentile outcome of just like how guys perform, maybe add, you know, one more bat, assuming, you know, everyone's healthy and all that stuff lines up. The rotation is fine. Obviously Gausman is a great guy to have at the top, and I think Berríos will be a bulk innings guy. I think you might want to add one more guy there. But then you also have like Manoa and Tiedemann and like some guys that, you know, you might reasonably think that those innings are there, depending on exactly how you interpret that. And then you then look at the bullpen and you're like, okay, it's like fine. It doesn't like blow me away. Obviously, Chad Green has been good. I don't see another shutdown guy. If you were to compare this roster to like what San Diego is doing right now, they have like three extra stars in the lineup that are all generally performing, and then somehow have like six or seven good starters, and now they have five good relievers. If you're trying to compare it to that roster, then it's like, all right, you're going to need to add, you know, four pitchers and two hitters. But like, there's teams that make the playoffs. I mean, we see Tampa every year where it's like, oh, there's like, you know, two or three good players. And like, if all of the guys do what they're supposed to do and stay healthy, which, you know, doesn't always happen, I don't think it's like a wild jump that needs to be taken, because there were so many injuries, underperformances, a prospect didn't come in and fill that spot, or, you know, kind of bad luck here and there. Like, I think the team is better than the record is this year. And so if you can then improve a modest to, you know, solid amount, like, it's certainly reasonable that there could be an 88 to 91 team that could catch fire at the right time. Like, I mean, you watch this team every day. Do you feel like it's wildly different than that? I don't think they're that far away, even though looking at the standings makes it seem like they are.
Yeah, I'd probably put it, I think they really need two more pieces on the position player side. Like, I don't know, like third base and left field or DH, you know, however that shakes out. I think you have a couple of those spots locked in. And then, like, I'm not, you know, you probably need a split time catcher with Alejandro Kirk or whatever, but third base and left field are kind of where I'm looking. Like, you gotta upgrade those spots. I like Ernie Clement a lot as a bench piece and a dude. Can't go into a winning season with a, you know, a 700 OPS third baseman kind of thing. So yeah, I think, look, it's the three wildcard era. It's not that hard to have a good, like you said, a 60th percentile outcome season for guys. And then you suddenly have 185 games. You make an ad at the trade deadline. I don't think they're crazy far away. But like, I do think there's some work to do with the, I don't know. I estimate them having about 60 million in budget room after ARB numbers and things like that. So, you know, you're going to have to spread that across. You need pitching depth. You need half a new bullpen and you need probably two bats. I'm not pessimistic, but I'm a little skeptical of just how tight that tightrope is.
Yeah, we're talking about like adding like four, maybe five real guys. Yeah. So that means you got to get them for an average of 10 to 12 million, which to me sounds like three free agents and two controllable guys you get in a trade, which means you have to trade prospects, which then means you're clearing out some depth.
Down to 24.
Ideally you want to nail a couple minor league free agents that then turn into useful guys that year, which the average team gets like probably 0.5 of those guys that turn into being like a real part of the team for almost no money. So, you know, that might be an 80th percentile offseason to then be able to expect a 60th percentile performance within the season to then be in the mix to like matter. So it's like, that's, you know, some hurdles, but like three or four teams will have that outcome out of the 30. So like, it's not impossible. It's just, you know, things have to go well and you have to do a good job and you got to be a little lucky and, you know, maybe hope another team in the AL East has like a underperforming season because it's a really good division.
Sure. That happens in the AL East all the time, right? That's a regular thing. And then there's the question mark of, you know, and this, I got to let you go here, but a question for another day of, you know, is it the same front office operating that operated the last couple off seasons and how that changes? We'll talk to Ben Nicholson Smith about that on the other side. Kylie, very quickly before I let you go, I have Eric Longenhagen coming on the show a little later as well. You guys co-wrote that book. Like, what's it like when you guys like disagree on a prospect ranking? I know I talk about it all the time on the show. Future value. Everyone should buy one. Buy two, even one for you and one for Eric. What's it like? Do you guys disagree on prospect? Like, will you message him and be like, you're way too high on this guy. He sucks. That kind of thing.
It's funny because like sometimes the way I find out is when I'm looking up a guy, I sort of habitually go to Fangraphs to just look at a guy's stats and I'll see the prospect ranking at the top of the page sometimes and I'll be like, ooh, Eric. And then I'll write something and sometimes I'll see what he wrote. He'll then see what I wrote and then text me like, George Klassen, like we just don't agree on that guy. And I was just like, it's okay. Like I'm fine being on the high end for that guy. It's usually not a matter. Like we have the same information and we interpret it differently and we focus on different things and talk to different people, but we have, you know, functionally the same, like his pitch grades on Klassen are the same as my pitch grades on Klassen. He just thinks the relief risk is bigger and the command grade is lower. And I was like, okay, that's something people can reasonably disagree on. Usually it is not a giant disagreement. We also end up pooling some information when it comes to TrackMan sheets and stuff like that. So sometimes I'll write a thing next to a guy's TrackMan numbers and be like, I'm going to rank this guy here. And he'll say it and just be like, oh no. It's like, well, we had the same answer every time. Then nobody would need to employ us. They need to employ one of us. And then the other one would just end up with all the same stuff. So you kind of need to be different. And yeah, there's room for friends and former colleagues to disagree. And it just means the odds of a second book go down every day that he disagrees with me.
And I mean, it's a good approximation of how front offices work, right? Everyone's dealing with the same information, sees the same guys, but two different front offices can see things just a little differently. And that's how you end up finding ground on a trade. Kylie, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Really appreciate it. There is someone squeaking at you. You got to go.
I think I got to go throw a frisbee in the backyard. Yes.
Yeah. Kylie McDaniel, baseball insider at ESPN, author of Future Value, all around great guest. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Ben Nicholson Smith joins us on the other side as JSTOC Plus continues on the SportsNet Radio Network and SportsNet 360.
Hey, it's Ben Ennis.
And I'm Brent Gunning.
We got you covered on all things Leafs, Raptors, and Blue Jays every weekday morning, 6 to 9.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, and I should not be texting our guests. I should be hosting the show. Ben Nicholson Smith of Sportsnet, of At the Letters, joins us now. Ben, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing well. Were you just texting me?
No, I was texting with Kylie. Kylie McDaniel was just on, and then he sent me his dog had been squeaking a squeak toy at us during the show, and then now he sent me a picture of the dog in the corner with the squeak toy, all quiet and cute now that the segment's over. That's all.
Well, I'm glad I didn't miss any texts. That's good news.
No, but you can bring Lou onto the show, though, if you'd like, if we want to make it a whole animal show.
Careful what you wish for. Yes, careful what you wish for.
By the way, speaking of careful what you wish for, it seemed when you were on the J.D. Bunkus show the other day that you're wishing for some problems between us here. You're insinuating I'm a bigger nerd when it comes to the contracts and the spreadsheets in baseball than yourself. That Look, I embrace the being a nerd part, but that seemed like misrepresentation of the dynamic between us here when it comes to the nitty-gritty roster stuff.
Yeah, it's hard to be nerdier than someone who spent 5 years writing on MLB trade rumors, working on arbitration projections, working on, you know, all the behind-the-scenes roster machinations that happen there. First of all, it's not a competition, and so I'm not trying to win at being a baseball nerd by any stretch, but I definitely am in that category, and there's no way around that.
Yeah, it's tough. And yes, you do have the MLB trade rumors cred. I guess this was going to be later in the segment, but this is a serious question that I don't imagine the average fan cares that much about, like the relief pitcher churn that we're going to see the next little while here. The Jays have four open 40-man spots and could open up a fifth by putting Alek Manoah on the 60-day IL. How much are you like refreshing MLB trade rumors, looking at the DFA list on Fangraphs and things like that, wondering who the next Yerry Rodriguez is going to be right now?
Well, they definitely need to make some claims, right? Like, they need the help on the major league staff. They have the opportunity. They have the innings. This is one of the, I guess, I don't want to say advantages, but it's one of the byproducts of being a bad team, is that you can give opportunity to players that wouldn't have it elsewhere. And so the Jays need to be making those claims, whether it's for position players, probably more so pitching, I would think, just given the state of their organization. This is the time to do it. So take your shots and see what you can do.
Yeah, and look, again, none of those guys are going to be absolute home runs, especially immediately, but teams all around baseball find guys that are a waiver claim. And then, I mean, the Red Sox have Bernardino in their bullpen, who they plucked out of the Mexican League this time of year two, three years ago, or someone else plucked him out and then the Red Sox acquired him, and now he's like an everyday reliever. They got him out of the Mexican League this time. Jordan Romano was a Rule 5 guy who got returned. Like, you can find guys. It's just going to take some churn to find that gem.
And the more spots you have, the better your chances are of actually finding someone. I mean, you look at the Dodgers and Evan Phillips, and I know Evan Phillips has been really bad for the last like 6 weeks, but set that aside, okay? So you look at what he's been able to do as an LA Dodger, he was claimed on waivers. So that tells you that there is that potential, especially with pitching and especially with relief pitching, because relief pitchers, you're talking about two pitch guys. So it's, you know, they're one command adjustment away, they're one grip change away from being a totally different dude. And this is an area of great need for the Jays.
And the other Dodgers example, I mean, Evan Phillips has gone down, but Brent Honeywell's thrown 12 and two-thirds innings for them, allowing, I think, one run. And all they really did were just like, throw your screwball more, man. Throw it 35% of the time. It's your best pitch. Let's do it. So that'll be fun to see. Dust having settled here a little bit on the deadline, we're mostly going to talk 2025 stuff here. But now that you've had a day and a half to sit and process it, know you dropped a notebook today, how do you feel about the work the Jays were able to do the last week?
I think it was a great deadline for the Jays, honestly. Like, they got a lot better. They traded away players who were not going to help them beyond 2024. Obviously, IKF and Nate Pearson being the two exceptions there. But essentially, they're trading pending free agents, and they got real talent back. I mean, Jake Bloss, Joey Loperfido, Charles McAdoo. There's some guys here who have actual upside. So, yeah, I think they did a great job. I think it was a really, really strong deadline. I mean, look, it's still in the context of a bad season. It's still a farm system that needs a lot of work. So take nothing away from the bigger picture here. There are still some major issues, and it's not a guarantee that they can contend next year by any stretch. But as long as we're talking about this week, this deadline, I think it was really good. And I'm not going to, I don't think that we need to shy away from saying that, even if this entire season is a disappointment.
Yeah, I've kind of tried to hit that tone on the show, is like, didn't want to be here, failure that you're selling, but good deadline, but now you got to do a lot of work for 2025. Before we talk about that 2025, and this is relevant to 2025, but you did just drop a notebook at sportsnet.ca, and I wanted to ask you about a couple of nuggets that you had in there. And one of the more interesting ones, it was kind of in the rapid fire section at the bottom, because I've gotten asked a lot, if this was such a seller's market, if you could get that for Kikuchi, why didn't Chris Bassett get made available? And I just spoke to Kylie McDaniel about it. And, you know, it's about how many teams are shopping for starters. I've talked to Chris Black about it. And it's like, well, okay, Kikuchi, you know, has the higher stuff and maybe moves to a bullpen in a playoff game in a way that Bassett can't. There's also the term and things like that. And your note in there was that the market for Bassett was less than it was for Kikuchi. Is that a fair read?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that, to me, it comes down to two things, price and ability. And I think that the perception is that Kikuchi has better ability, and his price, just objectively, as far as dollars, as far as salary, it's half of what Chris Bassett makes. He's earning $10 million. So, yeah, you're talking about someone who is more affordable. He's going to be attractive to a wider swath of teams, including maybe some smaller mid-market teams like Minnesota, San Diego, Cleveland, Milwaukee. They can all engage on Yusei Kikuchi. They can't all engage on Chris Bassett. And then you get to the fact that Kikuchi just throws harder, has more swing and miss stuff. It's less about deception. It's less about keeping hitters off balance, you know, managing the pitch clock and doing all the things that Chris Bassett does, to his credit. But yeah, like, who are you going to use? And I know this is a rhetorical question, but who are you going to use out of the bullpen in a playoff game when, you know, you're up two runs, you're trying to clinch an ALCS? You're not going to Chris Bassett. With all due respect to Chris Bassett, you are not going to Chris Bassett. You can go to Yusei Kikuchi in that situation. You can pay back him into the third inning. You can have him start game one of the ALDS. Like, Yusei Kikuchi is just, he's a very different pitcher than Chris Bassett.
Yeah, and I think that that's reasonable. So, I also think it's reasonable that the questions are coming in. Hey, if you could get all this much as a seller, why didn't you sell more? So it's important that we explore it, but you can also understand the reason why. Another note that you had in your piece there is that, and this is a super interesting one because it's very counter to how the front office has operated. The Jays did engage with Danny Jansen in extension talks before the season.
Yeah, so my understanding is there was an extension offer on the table for Danny Jansen, and obviously never got past the finish line, didn't happen. But that's a player that they obviously really liked, and he enjoyed his time here, and he was a big, big part of this organization, as you know, Blake, because I'm sure our listeners know as well. Like, he was really well regarded, and so there was a push at one point to keep him here longer term, and just didn't end up happening.
Well, the Jays have a need at catcher this offseason, and he does have a 1.2 OPS since joining the Red Sox. So who knows? Maybe visited down the line there as well. Okay, let's start to look at 2025 here. And obviously the first piece of business heading into the offseason, there are a lot of pieces of business, but I think the biggest one, and this is the headline item in your notebook, is the focus shifts a little bit now to, especially with how well he's playing, are you going to get a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. extension done? Now, the better he plays, the price of the brick going up and things like that, maybe it's hard to find a middle ground. How uncomfortable would it be for this team to operate a we're trying to compete in 2025 offseason if that Vlad thing is still, and to a lesser extent, Bo, but operating as a win now team if that Vlad extension's not done? How uncomfortable could that be?
Well, we might soon find out. I mean, to me, if that extension does get done, it probably happens in February or March. I mean, just typically when you look at the cadence of these things, it doesn't usually happen in September. It doesn't usually happen in October. So the Jays are free to do that sort of deal with Vlad Jr. whenever they want. There's no rule. There's no hard rule saying they can't do an extension today. But typically those things extend into the spring. So yeah, it's very, very possible that they will go into next season and that they will conduct the entire offseason without certainty on Vlad Guerrero Jr. And that is going to be a challenge for the front office. I don't think that it's achievable. You can still do that. And then you can go and address Vlad Jr. and see what kind of appetite he has for a deal, which we believe to be there based on every comment that Vlad Jr. has ever made publicly. Certainly seems like he's open to staying in Toronto, but it becomes a question of price, right? Years, dollars. We can all say, yeah, sure, $200 million over 10 years. Great. Well, that's not going to get it done, so it doesn't matter, right? Or Vladdy could sit there and say, yeah, sure, just give me $600 million. I'll sign for life. And okay, well, the Jays aren't going to do that. So what's the number in the middle? What's the years? What does this actually look like? I mean, these are really big questions. I don't want to underestimate how challenging that could be, but the reward is potentially there for both sides if a mutually agreeable deal can be found there.
And then the same conversation is there for Bo Bichette, although, you know, for whatever, probably because it's been such a down year and there were trade rumors and things like that. That one feels slightly less likely, but I'm sure they'll explore it as well. So let's put Bo and Vlad extensions aside, because like you said, those things tend to happen more in February, March. They're going to have to operate November, December, January, and build this 2025 roster out around those guys as if this is a team that intends to win. Now, having had a good trade deadline, I don't know that anyone who came back has a for sure day one starting spot on the 2025 team. Jake Bloss is obviously going to be in the mix. Joey Loperfido is going to be in the mix somewhere. Will Wagner could make a push, etc. But a lot of what they added is, hey, the bench will be a little bit better. The depth will be a little bit better. Maybe SP5 is a little bit better. That's more about restocking the system. And part of that could be for trade. But for the Major League roster in 2025, it's probably going to have to be a lot of free agent work, right?
I would think so. Yeah, I agree with your assessment there that really you look at the guys that they got back. I think Loperfido's on the Major League roster opening day next year. Class A probably has a really good shot at that. Who knows? Maybe Will Wagner too. But there are a lot of variables there. And when it comes to Bloss, he's got a really good chance. But who knows? He's only 23 years old. It wouldn't be wild for him to need a little more time at AAA too. So yeah, they have just so much work to do on the pitching side in particular. You look at this Major League pitching staff, and this was, remember, a bad bullpen before the trade deadline. Then they traded away three relievers. So it's not going to get better. It's going to be a really bad bullpen down the stretch, and they are going to have to find solutions on the fly. Now, maybe some of those solutions start to emerge and things shift, and that's where those waiver claims come in, and they have to find ways to answer that. But they need probably a starting pitcher, maybe multiple starting pitchers, multiple relievers, clearly, probably a catcher, and a bat of some kind, because they have a lot of guys who could emerge offensively, but not a lot of certainty. And I think you need someone to pair with Vlad Jr. And I think that's probably where they're going to devote a fair amount of free agent focus, is to adding a legit major league bat to the middle of that order.
And this is where having so many guys with positional versatility helps a little bit. You know, hey, if a third baseman materializes, okay, well, that's great. Loperfido can help out in left field. David Schneider can play some left field. If it's a second baseman that materializes, okay, well, Spencer Horwitz can play some first base and DH. If it's a left fielder that materializes, okay, you've got a couple different – Spencer Horwitz can play some second base. You've got infielders and things like that. So you don't have to go into the offseason locked in, although it would seem like third base and left field are probably the easiest areas to address, not only because those positions historically have a little bit more pop in those bats, but just the way things lined up. Like, you know who's in center and right. You know Vlad's there. You know Bo's there. You know Kirk is half the catching tandem. Is that probably, like, if you're firing up the free agent list, are you looking third base and left field first? Is second base in there, or has Horwitz played into enough of a role there? How are you, you know, taking a look at that free agent list first?
Yeah, I would look at second base, third base, left field. You're not looking at center. Shortstop if they trade Bo Bichette, which we'll see. But second base, Horwitz has been so good this year. That's great. You still want to see that he can finish the season strong. And even if he finishes the season strong, maybe you end up trading him. Maybe you end up signing a second baseman. There just have to be so many things that are on the table right now. I'm not trying to create, you know, unfair speculation or anything, but I just mean, like, you have so many different options. I don't think that Spencer Horwitz is so good that it's just like, oh yeah, he's our second baseman for the next 5 years. If your opportunity is to go get a second baseman, and that means that Horwitz shifts back to a first base bench bat, maybe he's even playing a bit more left field, that's fine. I mean, it's not like he is showing himself to be such a good defensive second baseman that you can't, you know, move him off that position. So I think that you just go in staying really open-minded and trying to just add a hitter to go into that middle of the order.
So I've taken a look, and we did this before the trade deadline as well. You and I sat down a couple months ago and looked at, okay, here's what the roster looks like. Here are some our bestimates and things like that. Not a ton has changed, other than, you know, IKF and Nate Pearson are obviously off the 2025 docket. I think we can pretty safely assume with certain relievers who have been DFA'd or up and down that they will not be tendered at their full arb rates and things like that. There's still the Romano question mark of how you handle him in arbitration off injury. I know you and I had talked about a multi-year deal, but having acknowledged all that, it looks like there's about 165 to 175 million committed for what's here. And then there's all this work to be done that we laid out. So 241 million is the CBT line for next year. Obviously there are those, like, other things that go into it. So let's say 225 is what you'd spend to get in there. 60, 70 million. How do you feel about how that would spread over, you know, we're talking about multiple bats, a split timer, backup catcher, a couple relievers, couple starters. Like, some of this will have to come from trade unless the budget comes in way higher than we anticipate.
Yeah, I don't think it'll come in way higher. This is, and we're going to hear from Mark Shapiro in a week, so we'll get clarity on this to some extent at that point. I think if anything, it might come in lower. Like I don't think that it would come in a lot higher than the CBT line. We'll see. That's speculation. A lot to unfold between now and opening day 2025. But if that is the money you have to spend, that's a lot. Like, I think that you could definitely add what you have to, and maybe you're trading from this, you know, I don't want to say surplus, but let's say this like collection of position players that you have now, where no one's necessarily jumping ahead of the field. So do you trade Barger for a reliever? Just again, speculative. Do you trade Horwitz for a starting pitcher? There are different ways that you can use this depth. Maybe you flip Class A. Like, who's to say that you can't use that to get something to help your pitching staff next year? Because their pitching staff is going to be older. This was a reason in the pro column for trading Bassett, by the way. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have traded Bassett, just to go back to that. I'm just saying that his value would never have been as high as Yusei Kikuchi. So, you know, you're going to need to find a lot of pitching this winter. Maybe that position player group can help you accomplish that. But on the free agent side, if you have anywhere close to that amount of money, you can get a bat, a starting pitcher, relief depth, and a catcher for that, and help your team meaningfully into 25.
You mentioned that we'll hear from Mark Shapiro next, I believe it's Wednesday of next week. What would you anticipate, and I'm asking you about Shai's reporting here, so I apologize for that awkwardness, but I know you have some of the same conversations. In Shai's deadline write-up, he had mentioned there were murmurs that Atkins could be on the way out, and then, you know, maybe that had quieted it down a little bit after the trade deadline, but there was a lot of uncertainty in where that landed. Do you think we'll actually get some clarity on that Wednesday, or are we going to tiptoe around the answer there?
We'll get as much clarity as we've had in months and months and months. So, you know, how much clarity? I don't know. But clearly that will be one of the first questions that Mark Shapiro is asked. And that must be a question that he's asked. And he obviously will be prepared to answer it. And he will know exactly what he's going to say. And so, yeah, I think that it will be one of two things. It will either be, we really believe in the work the Ross has done over the course of a big picture period of time, because whatever the case, Mark Shapiro will zoom out. It's not going to be about 1 week. It's not going to be about one season. So you can bank on that regardless of the answer. But he'll either say, hey, we zoom out. We look at what Ross Atkins has done. This is a really strong track record, and we believe in Ross. Or, and I understand some people listening are thinking, please don't have that be the answer. We'll see what he says. And then the other option would be, you know what? We're still in the middle of a season. Like anyone, we're going to evaluate Ross Atkins and the entire front office. We are all accountable for this. We all are trying to do the best thing we can for the Blue Jays. And we are going to, you know, continue to evaluate this. And that's like the, oh, doesn't look so good for Ross Atkins. Whereas the first one, of course, is like, hey, it's the vote of confidence. But as you know, Blake, sometimes you get the vote of confidence and you're fired anyway. So, sorry, I don't mean that to like geared toward you personally, but I just mean that's something that executives say all the time. So who knows? I would expect it's going to be a vote of confidence in some form.
Okay. Well, that'll be interesting to see on Wednesday. And then, of course, you know, again, it's even if you have a good trade deadline here, it's a data point. You executed it well, but you also were in a position to sell that you didn't anticipate being in. And there is a larger data point about the Major League roster and over the last 8-9 years. But like you said, Shapiro has generally tended to have Atkins back. Okay, Ben, refocusing on 2025, but with a 2024 lens, the rest of the way here, who are you looking at most closely in terms of what could this guy do in a 2025 role? Is it Joey Loperfido at this point, Jake Blas? I mean, there are a couple guys who were still here. Who are you most locked in on the next 2 months here?
To me, it's probably Horwitz, whether he can continue to hit like this, because if he can, that's a real bat. And the position will sort itself out, I think, with Spencer Horwitz. And then it's Blas, because Blas is someone who could be a number four starter in the majors. He could be a number three starter in the major leagues, and that's a big deal. So, yeah, those are the guys for me. I think not to write off a Class A or a Joey Loperfido, because I'm intrigued by them, but just based on the strikeout rate of Loperfido, that reads more fourth outfielder to me. You know, sorry to say, hey, that's good. Like, fourth outfielders are good. You need fourth outfielders, but not expecting that that is someone who's a transformative player for the Jays. In Class A, we'll see if he can access that raw power in games. That would be massive, but he's a little guy. I'm not holding my breath that he's going to just turn into, you know, the next Vernon Wells out there.
Yeah, it's and I mean, 80 grade speed is 80 grade speed. From an entertainment perspective, get that guy up here. Hope he gets on the bases yes. enough, because this has been like, I understand you can't retool what the team looks like on the fly here, but like them being a no power team that also doesn't steal bases has sucked. Like, I like at least be entertaining then, at least run the, and like, I'm not saying playing a little bit more small ball would have won 10 more games or anything like that, but just take a base here and there, have some fast guys if you're not going to have guys who hit for power there. With respect to Horwitz, is there any scenario in which you think he could like enter next season? Like, I'm going to ask you a question by giving you my opinion on it first. So I apologize for the way that this is going to come out, but there's no chance that he is, even though he'll be something close to an everyday player, like he's only going to start against righties on paper to start the season, right? Like his OPS plus against lefties is like almost single digits.
Wow. Okay. So do you have his numbers against lefties?
Yes.
Handy?
421 OPS.
Wow. Okay.
Now that's not a monster sample. It's only 29 plate appearances, but it backs up, you know, there were splits in the minors as well.
Yeah. So then he's profiling like a platoon bat, and that's, again, that's okay. Like, you need platoon bats, you need fourth outfielders, you need relievers. That's fine. That's not a knock on the guy. Is there any chance that he can be more than that entering next year? I would say yes. I think in the next couple months, try him against lefties. Just see what happens and see if you can take the strides forward. See what he can do in spring training. Keep pushing him. Keep testing him. And if he continues performing like this, I mean, you have your answer. But I think now is a good chance to keep seeing if he can take a bigger step.
Yeah, he was a high 600s OPS guy lefty on lefty at AAA the last 2 years, by the way. So it's just shy of 700. So I'm, and look, it's not like being a platoon guy when you're a lefty is a small role, right? Like you're still playing 120 games if you stay healthy and stuff like that. It's not a huge knock, but I did think I should mention it there. Ben, you're home. You're not in New York, right?
I'm home. I'm here in Toronto.
All right. Well, I will see you Tuesday? Are they off Monday? Tuesday. I'll see you Tuesday. Well, I'm having so much trouble with the schedule today, man. It's been a long week. I'm sorry.
No problem. Thanks so much, Blake. We'll talk to you soon. We'll see you soon.
Have a great weekend, man. Ben Nicholson-Smith. And it's Thursday, and I just said have a great weekend. Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of At The Letters. I clearly need a break. It's been a long week already. Great stuff from Ben there, though. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Eric Longenhagen of Fangraphs, their number one prospect guy, author of Future Value. Let's continue to talk about some of the haul the Jays got back and where they're positioned for 2025. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, wrapping it up here in a final segment. No Jays game today. Blair and Barker will be with you 4 to 6 later as usual, and then we'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to set up this Yankee series. And, yeah, it's trade deadline week. We'll probably still talk a little bit more trade deadline stuff tomorrow. You can text us, as always, to 590-590. Let us know how you feel about the deadline, any questions about the roster the rest of the way, or for 2025, hit us at 590-590. Standard data and messaging rates may apply. We talked to Kylie McDaniel a little earlier. He is the co-author of one of my favorite books from a baseball perspective and generally. It's called Future Value. His co-author joins us now of Fangraphs. It's Eric Longenhagen. Eric, how are you, man?
I'm doing well. It was very charitable of you guys to have Kylie on.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would have just done 2 hours of Eric Longenhagen given the choice, but you know, Kylie will do in a pinch. I did ask him in seriousness. I was so curious what the dynamic is like between you guys when obviously you co-wrote this book together. You both used to be at Fangraphs at the same time. When you disagree on prospects, what is that like between the two of you? Like, is there some trash talk? Is there some keeping an eye on guys to see who was right? How's that dynamic?
There's I don't know if there's a healthy rivalry or an unhealthy rivalry. Kylie and I have been friends for a long time, and you know, when ESPN came calling at the end of 2019, we were all happy for Kylie, and even though Kylie was like basically the biz dev wing of Fangraphs, who, you know, was coming up with like a scheme slash new business idea every week. And I'm pretty sure that Mickey Mouse is like, you know, has a gag order on Kylie doing any of that stuff. Like, it was, some of it was like, you know, pretty novel. But yeah, like, as far as us disagreeing about players, it happens pretty consistently with, you know, org by org, a couple guys per org. And I just, you know, I'll text Kylie and be like, you had this player where, or whatever it is. But mostly it's like, it's just from me being in Arizona and seeing as many guys as I can, like, living here, that, you know, generate some of those differences. And Kylie's, you know, on the Eastern Seaboard in Georgia, and sees that group of players. So I think we both have our strengths and weaknesses as far as what we're trying to do, covering a whole planet's worth of prospects, and I think folks can read Fangraphs and see for themselves.
Yeah, it's also like, it strikes me sometimes just how many there are. Like, where teams can have 165 domestic minor leaguers under contract, that means there are just shy of 5,000 domestic prospects. Like it's not as if you have them ranked 1 to 5,000. So there is obviously there's disagreement, and the better the prospect, the more kind of consensus there is on him. But I will use this to pivot and say that, as far as I have seen, at least from a top 100 ranking perspective, you are the high man on Jake Bloss, the headline item the Jays got back on a very busy deadline week. Everyone I've spoke to seems pretty high on Bloss generally, but you have him at 92 in your latest top 100. Believe that's the high mark. What do you like about Jake Bloss? What are the Jays getting here?
Yeah, Jake Bloss started his college career at Little Lafayette College there in Eastern Pennsylvania. It's Joe Maddon's alma mater, pretty small Patriot League school, transferred to Georgetown, and then entered pro ball, and is like one of the only guys from the 2023 draft class to make the big leagues already. So anytime there's a guy like this who is coming out of a small school and has made rapid improvements to the point where, like, he's been in the big leagues already, less, you know, about a year after he left Georgetown, that guy's improving pretty fast. And so that's a big one. For Bloss, you know, he sits 91, 93. His fastball's got characteristics that help it play up. He commands it. He's got a plus slider. Just think that he's big league rotation ready or close to it. He's the type of guy who is on, like, the fringe of being on a contending team's postseason rotation. Like, if we, you know, throw Jake Bloss's stuff with a little bit more seasoning and experience and, like, actual big league success on, you know, the Dodgers or the Phillies, like, that guy is in the mix to make their postseason rotation. And, like, that's the type of guy who tends to fit at the back of my top 100, especially when they're close to big league ready, basically. So, yeah, I like Jake Bloss a lot. Do I think he's got, like, monster mid-rotation, like, all-star seasons in him or anything like that? No, probably not. He's not that kind of athlete. He doesn't have that kind of size or, you know, superlative physical ability. It's just a guy with sneaky fastball, legit slider, and who commands, you know, all four distinct pitches enough to be a big league starter pretty soon.
You mentioned, you know, the success he's had pretty early on, right? And to go from a third round pick to already in the majors, I mean, there are very few guys who are going to do that. Maybe some relievers. You know, Paul Skeens was obviously the number one pick, and he's the most notable one. But how much do you, and this can be from the team perspective as well as your own perspective, change the opinion on guys over that first pro year, where I look at, you know, the Jays got 13 prospects back. Six of them were 2023 draft picks. Some of that is maybe, hey, you get the value where you can. But some of this is, you know, especially in the case of a Charles McAdoo, who they got back from Pittsburgh for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, a 13th round pick a year ago, and suddenly he's being talked about, you know, 13 months later as a real piece in a deal. Is that first pro year, like how important is that to you changing your opinion on guys, especially the guys who aren't those, like, obvious first round picks and top 100 types?
Yeah, you do end up having, like, this window of the season between when the sample, that they're generating at, you know, in the minors is too small to trust. And then there's like a tipping point where you can see changes compared to, you know, their draft year, especially with some of the smaller school guys. It doesn't apply to everybody. But, yeah, often, especially with some of the cadences of minor league baseball seasons relative to the draft, where there's not a big window after a draft to reevaluate any of these players. These players end up, a lot of the time, they get picked in a calendar year, and they don't end up playing pro ball until the following year, you know, very much if at all, especially if they're like college pitchers who have, you know, set a career high for innings that year, whatever it is. But it's, you know, there's like that gap, and development is occurring during that time. And then the next season starts and you want to see how guys have changed. And, you know, Jake Bloss is a pretty good example of that, where he goes from small colleges to Houston Astros pitching factory that was like partially responsible for a dynasty of sorts. McAdoo, I'm a little bit more skeptical of, just because of how much swing and missing is going on. But yeah, you do end up like once the first third or so of the minor league season is over, looking at guys who were just drafted last year and seeing all kinds of different changes. And the other thing that is important about that, I think, is those guys' 40-man roster and like Rule 5 draft clocks just started. These aren't guys who you have to say, okay, well, do we have to? I mean, some of the players that they acquired, like Edinson Paulino from the Red Sox, like they have to decide this offseason, okay, does this guy go on our 40-man roster or not, or do we expose him to the Rule 5 draft? And when players have just been drafted recently, that, you know, time horizon is as far away basically as it can be. You have another couple years to develop these guys before you have to decide that. So I think that was probably part of their decision-making process too. But yeah, like Major League Baseball development is so amazing, especially as far as pitchers are concerned. The guys can change really fast, and understanding who has changed from last year's draft class during that like window where it's every player is sort of like a black box who's just being developed but not really playing is very important.
So, okay, so that's good insight on Bloss and McAdoo there and that side of the strategy in general. I know you were writing these things up as the deadline was going, and you're updating the board over at Fangraphs, the top 100, and each org's farm rankings and things like that. With the benefit of 2 days here to process, what did you make of the Blue Jays deadline haul overall? Obviously, 13 prospects coming back across 8 different trades. It's a lot to contextualize, but now that you've sat with it, did you like the work the Jays were able to do?
Mostly, yes. I think at a time when hitters, you don't see big league hitters really moving as much during this window of time as maybe it was just a 1-year thing, but you know, for them to get as many hitters as they did back as part of this prospect haul, that was very interesting, and I thought it was like a pointed strategy. They're clearly targeting hitters in return for most of these trades. And, you know, I don't love every single one of the guys they got back. If there's an overall criticism of their approach, it's that these decisions seem very model-driven. Not that every one of these guys is exactly the same player. There are certainly guys who are more contact-oriented or power-oriented as part of, like, this group of hitting prospects they got back. But they're all guys who tend to look better on paper than when you actually watch them. So like McAdoo is a great example of that. When you look at the spreadsheet, the measurable power is comfortably plus. It's very exciting. When you watch him swing, you go, okay, there's a hole there and there, and big league pitchers are going to have their way with this guy. And that's true of some of these other hitters too. Yohendrick Pinango is probably the one where there's the biggest gap between when you look at like what he's done on paper this year with like contact rates and exit velocities and that kind of stuff. You go, why isn't this guy a top 100 prospect? And you watch him play and you're like, okay, he's a 5'9", like bowling ball type guy. His swing is vulnerable here and there. He can really only play left field. And oh, like his underlying chase is actually worse than has been exposed yet. Like they're all, and this is just true of most hitting prospects, is that Major League Baseball is really hard, and most of these guys can't do it because it's too hard. And that's going to apply to a bunch of these guys as well. But, you know, if there's one thing, it's other than Cutter Coffey and Josh Rivera, two, you know, shortstops who they got back as part of these trades, most of these guys are like kind of generic athletically, who are performing on paper. And, you know, it's nice to have guys like that around for upper level depth. But when a bunch of them are what you're getting back, it doesn't like really feel like some of them have a chance to be anything of impact. The RJ Shreks of the world, you know what I mean? So Jacob Sharp, like some of these guys, they definitely have skills. It's just like, oh, when I can see what the Blue Jays care about, and it's like what I'm looking at on my computer screen more so than anything else.
Yeah, that's and you know, that seems to, correct me if I'm wrong, but that seems to jive with a lot of, outside of the first round at least, what they've done in the last handful of drafts as well, right? Like there is a consistency on the position player hit tool and positional versatility side.
Yes, but I would say, you know, when you're drafting guys like Arjun Namal, like Tucker Tolman, they've taken shots in the draft on like toolsy guys. But yeah, you mentioned basically outside the first round. After that, it does seem to be like statistically driven decision making.
Yeah, I guess Tolman was a second round pick, but yeah, that's and he is not hitting very well. That one is not working out so far. Certainly not as well as Arjun Namala over the last couple weeks, hitting for a ton of power down there. So the Jays pick up 13 prospects. Seven of these guys rate 35 plus or higher. Like if we go to the board on Fangraphs, they kind of are guys who are quote unquote relevant. And then I guess six if we take off Joey Loperfido because he's graduated to the major leagues. And those things feed into the farm system rankings you have there. And, you know, the Jays are, they come in at 22nd. I think they were 25th on yours before the trade deadline. That just speaks to, yeah, it's good to have the org depth. It's good to have guys you can trade from a base. But really, it's those higher end guys, the Bloss and higher, that drive more of the farm system rankings. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, just the way our farm system rankings work is like, I kind of wash my hands of it because my player evaluations are all over it already. And so for me to go back through and then like subjectively say, I think the Braves are better and just sort of do it like that. We wanted to avoid basically double counting my own bias. And so Craig Edwards, who works for the Players Union now, used to be at Fangraphs, did a bunch of historical research on Baseball America prospect lists, yada, yada, yada. Anyway, what happens is the players who are towards the top of the overall top 100 are the ones that really tend to drive the farm system rankings, because having like a superstar player is what is most valuable than like a bunch of marginal role players. And so our farm system rankings tend to be driven by like who has guys towards the top of the overall top 100 list. And right now that's like the Rays and the Orioles, right? So with Aurelvis Martinez's PED suspension and Ricky Seidemann's Tommy John sort of nuking those two guys' stocks right now, the Blue Jays don't have anybody. Look at that. As much depth as I do, you know, I don't think they have a bad farm system. This is one of those things where you look at the farm system rankings and you should make like a subjective manual adjustment. And so like looking at the Blue Jays upper level situation, it's not bad. Like some of these guys who have graduated and whatnot, they're still young controllable players who are going to be part of the team's immediate future. I really do like Joey Loperfido a lot. I think that the guys who they have at the big league level and triple A level right now match up interestingly with one another, that like around some of the superstar hitters theoretically, right? Like we want those guys to hit like we know they should, but you know, Addison Bargers and Loperfidos of the world, those are the types of guys who you do mix and match around. Like good teams mix and match players like that around their superstar hitters every day, like play matchups with a couple of guys across their lineup. And I really think that like the pieces to be able to do that are here. They have enough opportunities between now and the end of spring training next year to decide which of these guys is actually going to play an immediate role effectively. So I kind of like their chances of like turning things around within 12 months compared to what their, you know, their farm ranking is, which is not awesome. But you know, those rankings are pretty, they're flawed. Like I acknowledge it. Sometimes your farm system ranking is low because you graduated players to the big leagues. Like how is that bad? So these are some of the, you know, the issues with things like farm rankings. The Blue Jays definitely do not score out well just because they lack those top end guys right now, especially with Tiedemann and Aurelvis being, you know, out. And so that's having an impact, but I actually think things are like going okay. They've executed a plan that would seem to put them back in the mix right away next year, provided that they can continue to add pitching depth. Like, that's the thing. It's you have the three guys who will be here for a couple of years, Bassett and Gausman and Berrios, and then Bloss and like Adam Macko are the two other guys who seem feasibly to be the young like prospects who can compete for rotation spots next year. But that's not enough guys. Yariel Rodriguez should probably be in the bullpen. And so you really don't have enough starting pitching for next year. And like, that's the thing to watch them try to add between now and the start of next season, if they're really going to dip their toes back in competitive waters again.
Yeah. And that's part of, you know, it's always a funny thing in baseball. If you're in a contention window, like nobody planned, this team did not plan to sell. So they didn't plan for this to happen. But you have a deadline where you sell off, and immediately the question is going to become, well, what can you trade some of? Now you've got a lot of position player prospects. What can you trade them for? So that'll be fun to watch. Eric, I mostly wanted to talk these trade stuff with you, but while I have you, Arjun Amala, since going back to Dunedin, so started the season with that aggressive placement in Dunedin at A-ball, got taken out, went on the development list, played a couple complex league games. He's been back at Dunedin for 25 games, only hitting .231, but seven homers in there, 15 extra base hits overall. The strikeout rate's still high in the 30s, but not quite where it was before they pulled him to the developmental list. What do you make of Arjun Amala at, I mean, still just 18 here at A-ball, and that kind of up and down, but maybe trending in the right way start to his season?
Yeah, obviously, things were rough enough at the beginning of the year that it was very scary. It is pretty rare for guys to swing and miss as much as he was and be anything at all. Like, it is sort of in Drew Jones territory where right away you look at the stat line and go, uh-oh, this is more than just someone going through an adjustment. This might be someone who can't do this. But, you know, things have definitely gotten better the last couple of weeks. When you look at the way his season has tracked as a whole, if I'm just like looking at my spreadsheet, like I am right now at some of the contact numbers, they're only a little bit south of average, like minor league average. And so that's encouraging that he has rebounded to only be a little bit below average from the contact, standpoint. But, you know, the power is here. Like, I'm looking at it. It's a standard deviation above what is typical for a guy his age. It's exactly what you would expect, having watched Arj like throughout his entire high school career. So, you know, I think it's encouraging. I think we want to see next year what they do. How aggressive are they going to be with him being promoted? I like to see him like get extended look in full season ball, like leave the complex in Dunedin by the end of next year if he can. So I think it's going to take time. He'll probably have to make an adjustment like this at virtually every level. And then the other thing that I'm, you know, curious to dive into here again this offseason is, how does this guy look on defense? Because that was a big question. That was more of the question when he was drafted, is can this giant 17-year-old stay at shortstop? And I think, you know, at some point here he might have to, if he's going to continue to swing and miss this much. But you know, so many players like go through it at some point or another, have to make adjustments. Sometimes when you're Jackson Holliday, it doesn't happen until you get to the big leagues. Then you have to like go 0 for 25 in front of everybody rather than do it in Dunedin. And so like, maybe this will be good for Arj and, you know, the Blue Jays. But you know, I'll have slid Namala down, like his grade, just based on how, you know, volatile things seem, based on how much he's swinging and missing. But he's still a talented kid.
Yeah, it'll be fun to track on both sides of the ball, and fun to hear what you guys all say about next time you get a closer set of eyes on him. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time out today, man. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks for having me on.
Eric Longenhagen of FanGraphs. Make sure you're heading over there, checking out. I mean, they just had so much good trade deadline work over at FanGraphs. And then Eric is, of course, their main prospect ranker, Tester Askin, chipping in as well, and a few others. But you can go, if you go to FanGraphs and there's the drop-down bars, you can go over to prospects near the far right and you click on the board. That's the top 100 that Eric has been updating recently. And through the trade deadline there, you can also see anyone that has a future value grade of 35 plus or higher. So 50 obviously being the middle point on a 2080 scale, and then, you know, 40, 45 being like, hey, this guy's probably going to be in the major leagues, and then 35 plus, it's like, yeah, there's a chance to be, you know, to play a role in the major leagues and so on. We look at the updated 100, and again, Kylie has his coming at some point. Baseball America is going to update their internal top 30 for the Blue Jays early next week, and we'll break that down. We'll look at Kylie's top 100 at ESPN when that comes out. But if you're looking on the FanGraphs one, Eric has three Jays on his top 100, but they're all in the back 10. Jake Bloss at 92, Aurelvis at 99, Ricky Tiedemann at 100. Arjun Namala seems to be right now probably one of the more divisive prospects in the top 150-ish, we'll say, where, you know, Keith Law has him in his top 60. He's not in the top 100 on FanGraphs. He's been, you know, it seemed he was fringy top 100 at Baseball America as well. So we'll see. I love when all the updates come down within a couple weeks of each other. We can compare across and kind of dig in on why some people might be higher or lower. Pretty consensus with everyone we've talked to this week that Jake Bloss is a good get, whether that ends up being a number three in a rotation or a 4 or 5, a guy who's been quick to the majors, a guy we could see later this year, and a guy we'll definitely see at least in some aspect next year. We won't see any Blue Jays today. They are not playing. Blair and Barker will have you 4 to 6. We will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow. We will have no game to break down, but we'll set up that Yankees series. We'll continue to talk a little trade deadline stuff. We'll look ahead to the weekend and the rest of the season. Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, Yariel Rodriguez for that series against Marcus Stroman, Carlos Rodon, and then it's a TBA from there. And Jazz Chisholm's there now. Have a wonderful Thursday, everyone. We'll talk to you tomorrow.